this week what inspired you from the Nazarene Codice there.
Page 30. The section on Ephesians, where it says the darkened mind and mental futility, mm-hmm. Jewish perspective. Mm-hmm. Well, I didn't really want to, we all kind of know what that says, I think. But I wanted to go up to the paragraph above it, where it says, Roman monarchies often pictured and proclaimed themselves gods. Mm-hmm. Well, that to me, where it says the darkened mind and mental futility, that to me is what that is. If they have the capacity to think of themselves in that way, wouldn't they also think of themselves as or above God?
Sure.
And see that also, wouldn't that be kind of placing themselves as an idol?
Absolutely. There's a story, and I think it's Josephus, if I'm not mistaken, that talks about Augustus, I think is the right name. He had a garment made from special, it's almost like a sequins type of material, that he built this garment out of silver and gold. And so you can imagine, you know, when the sunlight shone on this garment that he was wearing, that it reflect the light that was in there. So he was standing in the facing the morning sunrise, and then the auditorium with everybody was to the west, right? So when the sun comes up, it hit this garment that he had, and it just shined light everywhere as if he's, quote, this God. Mm-hmm. And God immediately said, that's it.
Oh, that's in the Nazarene Codice in 2 Lucas.
Is the whole story? No, the story's not there. It tells of him when he dies, but it doesn't tell the story.
Yeah, exactly. Him.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it tells
they began to proclaim him like he's like this
God.
Is the voice of God,
right?
Not of man.
Right, exactly. So that was a very interesting thing. So we'll talk. We're going to actually probably touch on that a little bit with a couple of other things this evening.
Can I say something else?
Sure.
And if you have people like this ruling the country or the city, where was I going with this? I forgot. It not only is a deterioration of their soul, but also the people dwelling within the city, it deteriorates their soul.
Okay, let's look at this from two sides, okay? Because you're absolutely correct. So, you know, the leadership that we have can denigrate our own soul, but at the same time, the leadership that we have is exactly the leadership that we deserve.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this is very, very difficult, right? Because, you know, all of us look and say, you know, we don't deserve this. And perhaps the God-fearing people do not deserve this, but by and large, the overall
corporate
mentality
deserves it. With exceptions.
So wherever you're at, whatever government and et cetera that you're under, that's what you're going to get.
Right.
Okay, very good, very good. You're Ricky Wara.
Well, there's a few things, but the on page 28, the footnote on number 48, where it talks about they knew God. I was taught this scripture in Romans. Romans has been phenomenal for me since you started translating it. It has been a phenomenal eye-opener for me because I thought I really knew it. And boy, did I know it wrong.
Right.
But anyway, the end of the 48 on the footnote, it says, it goes up to, the wisdom of the world, philosophical or otherwise, cannot know God. In other words, the world or the cosmos, pagan earthly system, cannot even achieve the level of Da'at. Herein is the blinding veil which covers the minds of the unfaithful. 2 Corinthians 4, 3 and following. Once the Messiah is shined on the soul of the Gentile, the true nature of that soul shines forth. If the resident soul is that of the Nefesh Yehudi, that neshama will embrace the Torah, oral and written. And I just thought that's so true because I've seen it happen so much. And I really feel like there's people that have been in our life that are returning
yes.
for that very reason.
Very
so,
good.
I thought it was interesting that today. So.
Yeah, very good. Very good. Okay, very good. We've covered the ladies in the room this evening. Now we'll start our front row with the Don Guel.
Enjoyed the Jonas and Jambres.
Mm-hmm.
I always love the idea of thinking of Targum Yonatan as being kind of foundational to the Nazarene Codicil, since it was written during the first century, or even before, by one of Hillel's prime students. So, since it's only found, first of all, there, and then in the Nazarene Codicil, it's a little enlightening. It's not found
anywhere else. But it corroborates the fact that the validity of the Nazarene Codicil. Okay, so, and we talked a little bit about when it was written, but it most certainly was, and there's a lot of scholarly debate on when it was written and who wrote it, of course.
I've read even some claim that it was touched up or went through some editing in Babylon.
Redacted, But much of the material comes from Babylon, and there's no problem with that at all. There's no problem with it whatsoever. So we'll get into that tonight. It's very interesting. But on Suriel, did he have time in the midst of his busy week to...
I did read it, and there were several things as I was going through there, but for some reason tonight, the one thing that stood out in my mind was the allegory of Har Sinai and the different names and why.
Very good.
I just hadn't paid attention to that before.
Well, the way it works a lot of times, though, is some things, we've read and read and read, and then all of a sudden, when our attention is drawn to this particular thing, then it turns out that, I didn't understand that. But on your Hoshua.
Both the points I had ready for tonight have already been discussed. The Jambres and the Nefesh Yehudi, when presented with the Mezorah, found, I don't remember how it was worded, but anyway, embracing, that was the word, embracing the oral and written form.
Very good. Very good. Don Randy?
I'm like so many others about the Book of Romans, but where you've got the comment in 50, and they had enough knowledge of God to know to give him due benevolence, however they failed or refused to do so. And to me, that just more or less just sums up the modern day Christian churches.
Mm-hmm.
It's just down to it, to the heartbeat.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Very interesting. We'll get in that in a minute. But on Gabriel, does he want to make an input?
Part of the Nazarene Talmud that caught my attention. We spent quite a bit of time looking at that.
Yeah, this is the piece from, and the link is there, from Professor Paula Fredrickson. And she's quite a scholar, especially on a lot of the stuff that comes close to the first century, and I think she is a big scholar on Constantine. So it's a very interesting passage. I've used it before, but I thought it bore some significance here, along with the comment that comes just after that about those Gentiles who show respect for Judaism and their high state of honor, etc.
Is she furring or inning?
Who?
Constantine.
She's got a lot of information on there. Click that site and go to that site and look her up and I haven't read a whole lot of her Constantine stuff, but I know she's supposed to be an authority. John Elishah, what was his favorite part?
Your Eminence, I thought this kind of your section on darkening the mind was very interesting. And I don't know why the thought never occurred to me, or more the realization, but it just kind of made me realize that, you know, when I think of punishment by God, you know, I think of like kind of a divine intervention of you're not, you know, keeping Torah, you're not doing whatever, so, you know, boom, you got cancer, or boom, you lose your wealth, or whatever. But I think it's interesting to just kind of see the logical working and the consequences of existence that he set as those justice scales. So, you know, if you don't focus on Torah, and if you don't focus on truth, you know, the logical consequences, your mind dulls, and you start making up your own things and start, you know, kind of your intellect. And so exactly. That's just kind of an interesting concept that I just kind of thought about, that I was like, oh, why haven't I realized this before?
Very good. But on Daniel, do you have something that you would like to comment on?
Yes, Germans. I just enjoyed the interesting paragraph regarding the Jews' perspective of Gentiles. That was enlightening.
Very good. Okay, anybody else want to make a comment before we move on? Everybody's good. Okay, page 28. What I would like for you to come to awareness of in the book of Romans is perhaps something that has not been the point of view, and I will say it like this, at least since the time of the writing of the letter and those that it affected in the first century. So I think that what's happened is obviously the information has been skewed. If you look even at the church fathers and look at their view, I have commentaries, not just all of the church fathers, but the summaries of their comments on particular books like Romans. And it's amazing how early on things were contorted by these church fathers. But one of the things that I want you to remember is when we opened up on the first pericope or first paragraph of Romans, we made a statement and we talked about Paul and him claiming to have a particular office under the authority of Messiah. And how did we make that title? He is under a Igaret Reshut. He's under a letter of permission to carry the Masorah to the Gentiles, absolutely. But he calls himself by a particular office. He says, I am a...
Courtier.
Okay. So, in other words, Hakam Shaul is saying, listen, and you should pick up on this because all of us should be thoroughly aware of the fact that when he says, I'm the courtier, and if you look even at your, say, King James, New King James, whatever version you have, he says that he is the courtier of Yeshua HaMashiach, called to be set apart by the Masorah of God. So in other words, his mission is through the... He's an agent for Yeshua, but his tool and the material that he's actually functioning in is the Masorah of God. Okay? So, in other words, he's a courtier of God. So that should set the tone for Romans for you to begin to understand some very profound things about Romans if you just slow down enough to not read it with the mindset that you have read in the past from whatever background that you may have come from, and then stop and say, I'm ready to receive this in a new and an open way and see what's there rather than keeping with the old program, etc. Now, this becomes very problematic partially because of the vocabulary, and so you have to be very careful with the vocabulary. So many times what we try to do is change the vocabulary, not for the sake of changing the context of the material, but to get the mind outside of Christian phraseology and terms, etc., that are used that carry this excess baggage. Now, if you were to look at Romans chapter 8 and verse 1 for a minute, it will be very clear what I think is being projected here, and that is, and I will just read it, I can semi-translate it as I go, but it says, "There is therefore now no condemnation to those who are in Yeshua HaMashiach." Okay, now the question would come immediately and say, why is there no condemnation to those who are in Yeshua HaMashiach?
Well, you want me to...
Go ahead, yeah.
If they're in Messiah, we shouldn't just take the idea that they're just a perfectly newborn babe, but in Messiah, we could also say that they are mature and have become faithful to the Torah. They put it into practice, and now there's no condemnation for them because they're following it.
Okay, so in other words, let's go to the book of Luke for a second. We spoke on this verse last week, Luke chapter 1. Verse 5, there was in the days of Herod, the king of Yehuda, a certain Cohen named Zechariah, of the division of Abijah, and his wife was of the daughters of Aaron, and her name was Elishama, and they were both righteous before God, walking in all of the commandments and ordinances of the Lord, and they were blameless. Doesn't that perfectly explain Romans 8 and 1? In other words, you can say that there's no condemnation to those who are in Yeshua HaMashiach because, as Adonijah well says, they've gained a level of maturity and they've begin to apply the Torah to their life. Now, the reason I came to those passages is because Hakam Shaul says that he's a courtier. He's a courtier in the court of justice. Now, this is one that drives everybody insane, or will hopefully drive them insane, is the fact that, guess what? He's in the court of Yeshua HaMashiach. And through this, he's come to judge. It's not a state of, I'm here to pat you on the back and say I forgave you all of your sins now, hasta la vista, baby, or whatever. He's here as a courtier. He is literally to carry the Masorah, but he's also someone who is functioning as a courtier in the court of the king. So you would imagine the jargon of Romans to contain a considerable amount of legal discussion. Everybody with me?
Mm-hmm.
Say again, someone was speaking.
That was me, and it's, that really makes sense because Hakam Shaul was the one who traveled so much, so for him to be traveling sort of to, keep everyone in line and direct them in their observance and to kind of smash quarrels or whatever, that really makes sense for why he is the one who's traveling.
Yeah, very good.
Well, even in small counties, you have a district judge who's traveling to different courthouses
right.
at different times.
Right. Exactly. We have that here. As a matter of fact, here in our particular county, we have something that's been happening. We have our circuit court judge now for the first time in, I don't know how long, it's been being contested. And he's the circuit court judge traveling around. Okay, but also keep this in mind as we move forward, and I'm reading from actually about verse 5 from my translation. It says, through him I receive chesed and the Igaret Reshut to bring Messiah's... Messiah and the... That's not that. Authority over all the Gentiles. Okay, so now you begin to understand that the courtroom and the decision that's made and what Hacham Shaul is trying to do is bring the Torah, bring the Masorah, the Torah to the Gentiles, thank you, that have the Nefesh Yehudi. Now, we're not just talking about just any Gentile. We're talking about those that have the Nefesh Yehudi inside. And that's why the comment was made that Gibra Gibora read about, you shine the light of the Masorah on a soul, and it's as if, you know, you've seen some of these things where they, it's like an x-ray. They can put the x-ray on you, and they can see inside of you and see what's wrong with you, etc. Shine the Torah on somebody and you'll see what's wrong with them. And if they don't like the Torah, it's pretty evident, and you shine the Torah on them, what's going to happen? They're vehemently opposed to the Torah. You know that no, he doesn't have the Nefesh Yehudi hiding in there. Okay, so he came for this purpose. That's what he's saying he's going to do. His particular occupation is function as a courtier in the court of Messiah and bring Messiah's authority over the Gentiles. And every Gentile on the planet should jump for joy that he did.
Amen.
The reason being, and I'm not talking about all the Christian mumbo jumbo, I'm saying the reason that he did was because before Yeshua, all of the Gentiles were under the direct authority of the intermediary that governed that area. And I'm talking about spiritual dimension, etc., over the top of them, okay? So, and this is what Hacham Shaul talks about in Ephesians, talks about all these different powers and etc. And it's very interesting that in Ephesians, he directs everything in the negative. Why?
Because it's
Dean. But actually, in that particular case, it's a balancing of back and forth of the different Pakidim, right? So you can say this is Dean, but if it's Dean, it's absolutely necessary, and because it's necessary, therefore it's Chesed. That sounds like we're talking out both sides of our mouth, right? I mean, discipline is discipline, and if we have discipline, I would personally, I say this and people cringe when I say it, I'd much rather be disciplined by God than to be placated and say, oh, good boy, tell me what's wrong and I'll fix it.
Right.
Instead of running around thinking, oh, I'm doing all this wonderful stuff, everybody thinks, you know, whatever, you know. So if you're doing wrong, let's be chastised, let's be rebuked, and let's understand that it was for our spiritual well-being.
Right.
Okay? Now, Ephesians shows it in the negative because it's to the Gentiles. The Jews don't need that. Not only do the Jews not need it, they don't have it. They're not subordinate to the intermediaries. Only the Gentiles. But now those who come into fellowship and faithful obedience to Messiah, then they subordinate themselves to Messiah, and then all of the other powers and principalities, etc., have lost their hold on those people. Let me say something right now. I'm going to take a little bit of a parenthetical sidetrack. Everybody knows that this Sabbath is the 30th day of Sivan. Okay? Next month on the biblical calendar is
Tammuz.
Very good. tells. Now, I said something last week to Adon Yehoshua, and I said, we're entering the dark time of the year. And I could hear him muttering, trying to resolve this issue about entering into the dark time of the year when the days get longer and hotter and longer and hotter, right? So how can I possibly intimate that we're entering into the darkest time of the year? Well, if we look in history, and we understand that on the 17th of Tammuz, which is just a few weeks away now, we will enter into 3 weeks of mourning for the destruction of the temple. And the first temple was destroyed on the 9th of Av. The last temple was destroyed on the 9th of Av. So,
the enemy would like to destroy this temple.
And exactly my point. Now, as spiritual temples of God, spiritual houses of God, the enemy wants to level you or I. So don't be surprised, Adon Suriel, at what happened. Okay? Now I speak to everybody and say, keep your spiritual guard up. Do not be found sleeping. Keep your spiritual guard up. We're entering into a time when it is extremely difficult for Jewish people and any of you who should think that you want to attach yourself in any way to Jewish people. Okay? So keep your guard. Keep your guard up. And
that's why Scott got hurt, huh?
Exactly. Exactly. Do you remember what time it was some years ago when you were at Gibor, you had a accident?
Yes.
It was somewhere around this time of the year. Okay, very good. All right, that being said, let's continue on. So, what I want you to first come to an awareness of the language of Hebrew, Romans is legal. Okay, so it's going to be courtly material that you would read in court, legal phrases, etc., etc. Now, if you look at verses 8 and following, you'll see him making a bit of a spiritual prayer blessing, etc., as we talked about in the past. And so then he speaks at the very end of that, and he says, I'm eager, this is my translation, it says, I'm eager to Talmudize you, and it should be in verse 17. No, it's verse 15, the end of verse 15. So that I'm eager to Talmudize you in the Masorah who are in Rome. So obviously, one of the things that you should understand is the Masorah, and what he's going to use is a legal tool to Talmudize the Gentiles. And this is the mechanism that is being used by Chacham Shaul to Talmudize, as it were, the Gentiles. And so therefore, all of the language and everything that the Romans are receiving is legal information. Now you should understand that for Rome, this was not a great difficulty. Their courts were well structured by and large. And so to find people who also had a very civil way of life and understanding that they governed life, all of life, by the Torah, etc., civil and religious as well, then you could see why Rome appreciated it. Okay, now at verse 18, we said the revelation of God's wrath coming from the heavens is against the wicked and the unjust men who intentionally suppress the truth. Now, last week we discussed somewhat how the rabbis had been brought under this accusation, and it did not apply to the rabbis because the rabbis are Torah teachers. But now let's flip the coin and look at all of the Christian scholars and all the Christian people who are in the pulpit on Sunday morning telling you that now that you're, quote, born again, you can live like hell. And there's no consequences.
Once saved, always saved.
And it's pure ignorance. It is absolute ignorance. And the problem is that the people sitting in the pew, I call them pew potatoes. Right? They're just sitting there to warm the thing up. That's all they're there. They're, you know, you go in, sing me a couple of songs, give me a psychological, you know, pump up mentally so that, you know, I can get charged to go out into the week. And then, you know, if I'm halfway spiritual, then I'll show up on Wednesday night and get another one. And it's the same thing. Okay? So all you don't have to do anything. All you have to do is just say a few words, and it's said, done, and over with. Okay, but now it says that God reveals His wrath. There's a revelation of His wrath coming from the heavens against all the wicked and the unjust men who intentionally suppress the truth. This is because even intimate knowledge of God, and you need to understand this for where we're going the rest of the way this evening, okay? For the intimate, even this intimate knowledge of God is evident to them because God revealed Himself among them. For from the creation of the world, His invisible attributes, both everlasting and virtuous, and by divine majesty, are discerned clearly, being understood in the things made, so that they are without excuse. Verse 21, because although they knew God, they did not honor Him as God or give Him thanks, but became vain and futile in their reasoning, and their unteachable mind spirits were darkened. Professing wisdom, chokmah, they acted foolishly and exchanged the glory of the immortal. This word does not do justice to God in this place. Okay? Immortal God with the images, idols, of corrupt human beings, birds, quadrupeds, and reptiles. Okay? Now, if you go in your commentary notes, to page 32, actually, go to 31. Last week we intimated and gave the hint that these passages of Romans are a citation from Psalms 106:20. From the Septuagint, it's Psalms 105, verse 20. Now, these verses, the Hakam Shaul cites from the Septuagint, you can look at the phrase that is that comes out of the Septuagint, and then Hakam Shaul adds a piece to it to show what is evident in, or what should be evident in our understanding of the text. Okay, so here, understanding that subliminally, or not so subliminal, but This rabbi, Hakam Shaul, has woven a piece of Psalms into the text as a hint. Okay? So he's given us a hint, and he wants us to understand and look at this piece of material from Remes. Okay? Everybody with me so far? This being said, you can understand that the inference from Psalms 106 and 20 refers to the sin of the golden calf. So, here's all the superior-minded Christian scholars who take Romans 1 and 21 through 23, and they twist it, and now this accusation is brought against the Jews.
But it should have been brought against those who were with the Jews, correct?
Exactly. So you see what happens? Because the Christians don't understand, although it is right in front of their face. It is right in front of their face. If they will look at the material, you don't have to do anything to the material to make it to understand what's being said. You don't. And it's like a Donuelo, and we were talking about the targums in the very beginning. When you talk about the targums, you look at the targum and you can see the inference of what's coming on here. And any scholar who's worth his salt can go to Timothy, where now on page 32, and see it says, where I quote Timothy 3:8, says, just as Jannes and Jambres opposed Moses, so these men opposed the truth. Men of depraved mind rejected concerning faithful obedience to God and the Torah. So now all of a sudden, it makes perfect sense what Hacham Shaul is saying in 21 through 23. Because he alludes to this, now I'll connect the dots, don't panic, okay? But if they look and they saw Jannes and Jambres, surely they should have been worthy enough in their mind mentally as scholars to say, I wonder where Jannes and Jambres are mentioned in any other literature, and then find such literature and say, well now. And my set of Encyclopedia Judaica is from 1918 or something like that. So that leaves all the scholars from that age to this with no excuse to understand what happened. Am I jumping the gun? Am I making conclusions that shouldn't be? Or is it legitimate? Let's go on. So you see these two men. And the first place, if you will look where I say first occasion on page 32, in the suit of Yonatan, Exodus 1:15, it said, and Pharaoh told that he had been asleep, and he had seen in his dream, and behold, all of the land of Mitzrayim was placed on a scale of a balance and a lamb. Now, what you should see here, if you'll also look down verse 85. This is a play on words in the Aramaic text, and it does not need to say a lamb. It is fine that it does, but it also could say a baby or a young child or an infant. So read it like this. He said, he saw on a balance all of Israel, and on the other balance he saw one child. And then he said, young of a sheep was ill, the other scale, and the scale of the lamb in it overweighed. So he sees on one side all of Israel, all of Mitzrayim, as if it were a lamb that was sick, ill, etc. And on the other side, he sees one that's healthy and whole, etc. Mitzrayim, and he said, it imparted to him the dream. And immediately in the bolded section, Jannes and Jambres, okay, so you see here from before Moshe's birth, you see Jannes and Jambres here as the chief of the musicians, and they opened their mouth and answered Pharaoh, a certain child. You see what they did? They understood that the lamb should be understood not as a lamb, but as a child. Okay? But stop and let all... You could stop right here, and we could take weeks just to discuss this particular part of this text by itself. If it's a lamb and it's a child, start doing the homework and putting all the hints together. I imagine how many hints are just in that single phrase right there. Okay? And you know that this happened here, what will unfold here, that Pharaoh is trying to unleash, which will be against Moshe, was mirrored by Herod.
Right.
Ecclesiastes. It happened once. Okay. So, it was a child is about to be born in the congregation of Israel, by whose hand the destruction to all the land of Mitzrayim. Therefore did Pharaoh, king of Mitzrayim, give counsel to Yehudit, the midwives. The name of one was Shifra. These names are unbelievable when you look them up. Shifra and the other is Yochaved. And named one another. Named of the other is Purva, who is Miriam, his daughter. So, first occasion where there's opposition against Moshe's life is in his birth. So this is how Pharaoh intends to deal with the situation, and throw the babies into the Nile and on and on and on and on. Okay, and so we're all familiar with the history, but this was the first place that Jannes and Jambres opposed Moshe. Okay, second occasion, look at Tarim Suda Yonatan 7:11. But Pharaoh called Hachims, this is undoubtedly like sages, and the magicians, and they also did as Jannes and Jambres of Mitzrayim, they did the same with their burning divinations. Okay, so here, this particular opposition is not specifically against Moshe. It's very interesting. It's against the priesthood. It's against the priesthood of the firstborn, because the Levitical priesthood is not in office yet.
So is that what the burning is? Is that what that means?
Part of this whole burning divinations is they're trying. That what they did is they throw down their rods, and Aaron's rod consumes the others. So this is a place where that they're trying to come against Aaron, Moshe's brother. So the priesthood of the firstborn, because at this point the priesthood of the Kohenite priesthood is not available yet.
What are the staves symbolic of? Because
it's there's tons of things. Just use that word eights and we can go crazy. Eights is like a tree, it's like a limb, it's like a branch. The shortest answer to that is a branch.
And it's also a cross. Could also be a cross.
Could be a cross. Well, let's just do branch, because branch is a reference to Messiah. So what do they have? Pseudo-Messiahs, right?
Mm-hmm.
Aaron's got his rod, which has the essence of Messiah. And what does it do to all the pseudo-rods?
Devour
the day. I think we'll have a few pseudo-gods for lunch. Okay?
Hmm.
Now look at the next piece of Suda Yonatan in Shemot 12:38. And a multitude of strangers, Gentiles, Gerim, etc., 240 myriads, thousands, went up with them, and sheep and oxen and cattle, very many. Go down to the next section, bolded, it says Jannes and Jambres, two legendary Egyptian sorcerers whose name appear in various sources as adversaries of Moshe. Jewish tradition seems to identify them with the sorcerers of mentioned in Exodus 7:11 and following, and it gives the Targum which we read above. And so they also are mentioned as sons of Baalim, so you would understand that they were
priests of Baal.
They undoubtedly had progeny that this mentions, because this is too late for some of the things that are going on here. If they exist before Moshe's birth, Moshe comes to deliver the people and comes to this awareness at about 80 years of age, so he can start to figure out all the details, okay? And it said that having played a part in the incident of the golden calf, having the mixed multitude that accompanied Israel in Egypt, and this comes, the citation comes from Kitisa and a commentary there on that material. So now you see that Jannes and Jambres are two that oppose Moshe. Now, what we want to do from this point forward at this particular place is try to come to an awareness of something that we should be able to do by putting all the pieces of the puzzle together. Let's go back to Romans for a second. Go to verse 24. We will make our translation of this. I'll use the New King James for the moment. Therefore, God also gave them up to uncleanness and lust of their hearts, to dishonor their bodies among themselves, who exchanged the truth of God for a lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. Now,
where was that?
124.
Okay.
And 25.
Find it in my translation.
But that was just New King James. I haven't sacrificed the
that cow yet. Oh, so we get to sacrifice
New
Cow next week,
huh? Okay. Allegory, hint, remnants. It's all in black and white. Right? First thing they do, number one, is what? No. Let's go back to what Jannes and Jambres did. What did they do? We have opposition against Moshe. How did they make their opposition? First,
trying to have him killed when he was
born. So they come against Moshe as an infant. Okay? Number two, what was the second thing they did?
Challenged him when he came for Aaron.
They challenged
Aaron.
What was the third thing they did?
Challenge God. They spoke against God.
No. We gave you the material here, so you can see where it came from. Oh, Alicia.
The golden calf.
The golden calf. Okay. Now, we already have hinted here, first one. Okay? And here are two very significant events. What is in opposition here? What are these two, quote, magicians? What are they trying to accomplish?
Trying to accomplish not having Messiah. I mean, is there attack on Messiah because he's the firstborn to bring back the firstborn?
Okay, so here we can make that connection with Aaron and the priesthood of the firstborn, because there's not a functioning Levitical priesthood just yet. And so we can make that connection there. So that leaves us with the other two, and that makes a connection. And how do we interpret those allegorically?
I would say the Torah's authority.
So you're going to connect Torah's authority to which one, or both?
I would say both, Your Eminence.
Both. Okay, let's make it general and say, yeah, generally speaking.
Governance.
Okay.
No. Challenging the governance.
Okay, challenge the governance of God through his agent Moshe. I accept that. Why? Because we opened up this evening not by chance to say, Acham Shaul, the courtier, right? So we understand that something is warring against God and against one of his agents and against his tools. And the tool that is being fought against is not Moshe. Not Moshe at all. It's allegory, so it can't be Moshe, because if it was Peshat, it would be that we all we can understand and read the Peshat. That's simple enough. You know, they tried to kill him when he was a baby. They came with the sin of the golden calf, and they said, you know, I'm sure the devil got him. And he's not coming back.
This may be on a bit of a tangent, but what...
Spit it out.
That's hard to do here.
Okay. So Moshe, allegorically, has to be the Torah. Okay? So therefore, you see that they oppose not just Moshe, they oppose the Torah. They have come directly against the Torah.
That's the connection to this, the men in Romans. That's the full connection.
Exactly.
Because they're against not only the firstborn, but they're against, I mean, against the Torah, both oral and...
Yeah, if you go back and look at the way we... Yeah, if you go back and look at the way we translate, it said they knew God.
Right.
And they knew all of his events. How did they know all that? They've been through all the plagues. Hmm. And surely, and it's very interesting that there's a mention of creation in these passages. Why? Because the plagues unfold in the exact opposite order as creation. So what are they trying to do? They're trying to wreck everything. First of all, they're trying to wreck the Torah. The reason they're trying to wreck the Torah is to wreck the Torah because the Torah is the entire cosmos. Take away the Torah, there is no cosmos. So here they were against that. So that leaves us with the sin of the golden calf. Now, allegorically, reputation. You understand the events. Say it again, please.
Reputation of Jewish people. Make them look bad so that...
Which has been the case for many years, right? They've been put in a negative light because Christian scholars are not smart enough to look at the data and say, well, here's the data right here. Well, it didn't have anything to do with the Jews, but it's the mixed multitude.
Right, the church has taught my whole life.
Yeah, absolutely.
The golden calf, it was the Jews. The Jews turned their back on God, and
right.
They had this golden calf made because
right.
They didn't trust that Moses was coming back.
Right. Which now we understand. It's not that way.
Right.
But now, what does the final connection here, what is that war against? This is the double-edged sword. Right? Watch. Against the priesthood, because now, because the firstborn didn't get in there and do their business and whack their heads off, which should have been done, right? So, the priesthood of the firstborn, they receive the guilt for what's transpired here, so it's a sin also here against the firstborn, but it's still also a sin against the Torah, right? Where was Moshe in all of this? He was on Har Sinai. He was up there getting the Torah. And surely, you know, if we can prove that he's dead, then we can say there's no such thing as the Torah. And so it comes here to allegorically speaking against the Torah, against the firstborn, and then both of these together in that. So their efforts escalate as they move forward in time, and they're trying to say, we don't want no stinking Torah.
Right.
I'm seeing a correlation to the fact that they, when Yeshua was taken, they made him a false god temporarily.
Absolutely.
And then they made him a golden, like the false god thing where while he was alive was only temporary, and then they put him back in his regular clothes. And
exactly.
But then they turned him into a golden calf after he died.
In a matter of speaking, absolutely. In a matter of, allegorically speaking, he stepped outside of Peshat. Did you hear that?
Uh-oh.
Now,
now, let's go back to 24. Okay. Now, let me give you some ammunition. When you're reading Romans, from this point forward, in your mind, execute everything that you have heard about Romans. Throw it out of your mind. Don't even entertain those thoughts. If they become truth, they're truth. That's good. There's no problem. Okay? I'm not saying deny truth. I'm saying throw out everything that you've heard about it before, and then weigh the evidence and see what the evidence has to say. Because I'm going to tell you something. There's things in Romans, and perhaps I sound brash and somewhat audacious in saying there's things that nobody's ever seen before that you will see. And they're right before your eyes. And how they dance, and it's such a beautiful thing. So what I want you to do with Romans, in reading Romans, is slow down and take the time to think about it. Take the time to mull the verses over in your head until you get sick of mulling them over in your head and thinking about the possibilities, etc., that they could be inferring. So now that we know who the culprits are, the prototypes of the models of Jonas and Jambres, we understand who Hakam Cha'ul is speaking of. Are you with me? Questions, comments? It's very quiet in here.
So, the idea of speaking of Jonas and Jambres in that section is to remind us of their wanting to destroy the Torah, and it's connected to the church not wanting anything to do with the Torah.
Absolutely.
And so that's how this is all related. It's how it brings it all back.
So who are we talking about? The letter is written to who?
Rome,
Edom, Christianity. Okay? He's trying to... Now, let me say this. Here's where I'll give a theme for the book of Romans. The theme for the book of Romans is the defense against the Torah and against God, for God. In other words, to defend God and to prove that the Torah is valid and important as a part of our life. Now, that sounds like the exact opposite of everything we've ever heard. Now I want you to put on your thinking caps. You didn't think we were thinking before this point? This is going to be a hard connection for you to make, but we will help you. 24. Keep in mind who the accusations are against. It's as if we're in a court of law, and the criminal citations against particular people are being announced before the judge, right? Don't they always, when you go before the judge, they say this so-and-so did this and this and this, huh? Don't they? Therefore, God gave them up to uncleanness. Who's he speaking of?
Those that
refuse
the Torah.
Jonas and Jambres. Okay? Jonas and Jambres. So he gave them up to uncleanness in the lusts of their hearts to dishonor their bodies among themselves. Can I ask you what that would imply? What does that imply?
Homosexuality.
Homosexuality?
That's what the church teaches.
Okay, but see, I mean, if you make that connection, well, it's not wrong to make this connection, right? But if you make that connection, you see that he's speaking to Rome, but he's also carrying this back to Jannes and Jambres. So in other words, what do you see? Do you see what I see?
Probably not.
I don't know. I can't say what you see.
That can see me. Oh, not what I see. Look at...
Your Eminence?
Yes, sir.
Would I be accurate in saying, okay, well, man is meant for Torah, Torah for man, but they have gone... Or, let me say like this. Man is meant for God and God for man, but now they've gone, you know, man and creation, kind of in that, how we work in homosexuality, where you work, you would go with that is what is created and not supposed to be worshipped, and you're supposed to worship God, and so, does that make any sense?
No.
See if I can work my way through it.
I think I just napped for about 30 seconds.
Did you nap while you were talking, Don Alicia?
Okay.
Just a seizure.
In essence, I think we can explain what he said in this respect is that, you know, if you're following the homosexual practices, then what you're doing is you're throwing God's authority out, right? Is that is correct, Don Elisha?
I remember it's put some of more beautifully and succinctly than I ever could.
Okay.
Your mind is given over to darkness.
And then your mind gives over to darkness, and then does what? It has a seed of itself. But now let's understand the implication here, because there's something we need to draw out from this. Jannes and Jambres. Man and wife know
two men
implying
homosexuality.
Absolutely. That's what the way they were. And for that reason now we can look in here and say in 24 it says they gave them over to the uncleanness and lusts of their hearts to dishonor their bodies among themselves. Now, should you think that that's peculiar, there is an idea, although it's very difficult to prove, but in the Talmud, it said Potiphar. Did everybody know who Potiphar was?
Mm-hmm. Totally.
Potiphar was the one who purchases Joseph in his slavery, and he takes him into his house, and his wife tries to have her way with him, etc., okay? Wait a minute, I got a problem. Why is it just that Joseph is just so wonderfully good looking, and then there's the legend that he is, that even the girls, they climb the fence to try to see over so they get a glimpse of him. But is he just so gorgeously, you know, handsome that this woman can't resist him, or maybe is there some other things going on behind the scenes we don't know about?
Maybe because Potiphar is the same as Jannes and Jambres.
Ah!
He doesn't take care of his wife's needs, and so she goes to look for her needs to be fulfilled.
Did everybody understand? Potiphar's wife is not given due benevolence at home, so because Potiphar is on the other side, more interested in the same sex, than the opposite sex. And interestingly enough, in the Talmud it says that when Potiphar purchased Joseph, he purchased him for his own self.
Wow.
Even learned that in the Catholic Church.
Yeah. I'm sure you didn't learn it in the Catholic Church. And I don't think they'll be teaching it there tomorrow. Mm-hmm. A Are you firing on all cylinders now?
I just reopened up a cylinder.
One that was blocked up from before? Okay. So now I'm going to begin to hit on a couple more cylinders.
Can I say something? I'm sure everybody's ahead of the game maybe for me, but I'm thinking that Jonas and Jambres are mingling in with the 40,000 Jews that are leaving Egypt to make them or to lead them astray, kind of like the snake did in the Garden of Eden.
Absolutely.
Trying to darken the minds of the people so
that was their purpose or that was their soul. That's what they had in mind.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, they went for the first opportunity. They say they understand. They know. Yeah, Moses is not coming back for another 6 hours. Yeah. They know it.
Kind of like
and so what do?
An infection in a wound.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So they're there, and their whole goal is subversively to take the Torah away from the Jewish people or take the Jewish people away from the Torah. Mm. Now, you know, you ever play that game where, you know, you get a little coloring page and it says in one place it says 1, and another place it says 2, and 3 and 4, whatever, until finally, you know, you make this, oh, I see. It's a teddy bear with a kippah on. You didn't know there was such an animal, did you?
I'm looking at him.
You can tell that to my wife, okay? She has this little word she says is called osito. And also in Spanish, correct me if I'm wrong, Don Gabriel, because also in Spanish is a bear, right? He fell asleep. Okay, absolutely. Take care. Now, you there, Don Gabriel?
Yes, I'm there, but I can't remember the word for bear.
They usually use the word bear.
In English, we call it bear, okay? But in Spanish, it's an oso. So, somebody can look that up if they wish. But now, Dove, yes, in Hebrew, yes, very good. Now we have to stretch our minds a little bit. Are you ready? You haven't been stretched yet, right? Everything just, you guys made all these connections.
Oh, yeah. Simply before. No problem.
Help me out. You like history a little bit, huh?
Small bit, yes.
A little bit, just a little bit. Who were the founders of Rome?
Like, I know the mythology side better than I know actually.
So, give me a little, see if we connect.
In mythology, Roman mythology, Romulus and Remus were two brothers, and they were raised by wolves, and when they got older, Romulus and Remus both decided that they wanted to build a city, and they chose the same spot, so they fought for it, and whoever killed the other gained the right to build the city. Romulus won.
Then being Rom, Rom. Brothers? They're supposed to be demigods in mythology. Okay.
I believe technically they were demigods.
Supposed to be demigods, okay? But what if they weren't brothers?
They were lovers.
Oh
that's why it talks about Rome being so corrupt and so evil and so.
They fight against the Egyptians, fight against the Jewish people and the Torah, and they want to tear the Torah down, etc., etc. Within that the genre, you understand they're trying to prevent Messiah, on and on and on, right? And now we have Hakam Shaul dragging these illustrations and these connections into his writings, because he wants you to understand that just as Egypt,
so is Rome.
Germans, what if it's even worse than that? And not only were they lovers, but they were still brothers.
Then it becomes a whole lot worse, right?
That would be the point of Rome, wouldn't it? Is that it's... it gets worse?
Obviously, right? If there's bestiality involved in this whole ring of... Anyway.
Yeah.
See, I was taught that. But that perspective, I kind of just stepped away.
This is a Romans we never read before. Right? Did you ever read that in Romans before?
Sure.
So now you understand why I put this little snippet of information about how the Jews saw the Gentiles.
Very much so.
Mm-hmm. And listen to her words. Her words are so eloquent. What on average did, I'm on page 29, what on average did the Jew think of the average Gentile? I think that we can rely here on Paul. So where's the source material?
Paul.
So she's presenting at what we call a Pauline view, right, of Gentiles in the first century. And she says, who even when addressing Gentiles, in some sense acting as their advocate, refers to them quite unselfish consciously as sinners, such as in Galatians 2:15, and their characteristic social and sexual sins, slander, insolence, deceits, malicious gossip, envy, heartlessness, disrespect of parents, homosexual and heterosexual fornication, and they varied expression of more fundamental spiritual error. They worshipped idols. And could there be such a thing as a morally good Gentile? I think now that we can... You'll be okay Sunday night?
Oh, your minutes... You do remember the story of Good Samaritan, right?
Yes.
There can be a moral Gentile, but does that make one morally good?
Well, in the comment that she makes following that is that there are those who rather than persecute Judaism, the Torah, etc., have some merit because they're not in opposition to the Torah. As a matter of fact, there would be supporting of the Torah, etc.
One good Samaritan.
Okay, very good. Okay, so now what I would like you to do is to keep in mind the reading of Romans, and as His Eminence pointed out to you, and it should be quite evident that he opens up, Hakam Shaul opens up number one with the idea of being courtier, and here we have like a list of accusations or criminal offenses that are against, in this particular case he's speaking of Jannes and Jambres, but obviously then he will go on to discuss what I've erased. May it come to pass in our days. And so bear in mind this as we read the book of Romans, because there will be things that have been said about the book of Romans that you will say, well, this is how we learned it in the church, and I will take the exact opposite view and show you exactly what it says. And it will be so much fun. Can a guy have so much fun when he's tearing down all these idolatrous demigods that Christianity has built up?
But, Yerman, I believe I come in with an advantage and a disadvantage at the same time. One, I know nothing about Romans. So I have no bad misconceptions or preconceived
notions. So I have to break down, right?
It's my church that I went to when I was young wouldn't stop trying to tell me how David was 12 years old. That's pretty much it.
He was a ruddy complexion.
I guess what gets me when you get to thinking everything that you've said tonight is how the priests of the Catholic Church have been brought down because of the homosexuality.
And here we're back to Rome again.
Right back into it again. It just amazes me.
Yeah, let's put them in an environment that will breed that.
Exactly.
And that was the downfall of Rome, correct?
Absolutely.
I mean, that's the exact downfall.
Absolutely.
The Catholic Church was part of the Catholic Church. History repeats itself.
Yeah. When it talks about their lust, the lust that they have, they didn't. If you'll read on, you'll read the accusations. So we'll work through those in the citations against them in the coming weeks. This is, they forget their women and they burn with desire in the wrong way, et cetera, et cetera.